Welcome to STEM Spots, a weekly science review produced in cooperation with the Missouri State University Department of Physics, Astronomy, and Materials Science.
Hi, this is Dave Cornelison, and you are listening to the webcast version of STEM Spots. And with me in the studio today is Dr. Joseph Holgus, who's a professor of family counseling in the Counseling, Leadership, and Special Education Department at Missouri State University. Thanks for stopping by, Joe.
My pleasure.
So, Joe, once again, I'm going to ask you a question about why are you involved in drug abuse analysis and education? Tell us a little bit about your background that led you to this point.
Well, I'm a licensed psychologist, and I've practiced for approximately 30 years. And so it's not unusual for folks to come in dealing with some kind of substance use or abuse issue. Sometimes that's not the first thing they present, but it's not uncommon for that to be an issue or related issue in what they're dealing with, whether it's on an individual level or a family level.
Okay. So now you're dealing with people that have drug abuse issues, but at the same time, we're making major policy decisions at the nation level and certainly even the international level. And to do that, people have to have some sort of data. So talk about how people get the data sets they need to analyze the problem to begin with.
Well, there's a variety of governmental agencies that sponsor various surveillance activities, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration being chief among them, in collaboration with the CDC and a variety of other organizations. What they do is to gather a variety of different kinds of data. They have a variety of surveys that they have perfected over the course of time that they do repeatedly throughout the years. And looking at trends in the data where they sample from the population in a valid way so that it'll reflect the population as a whole, and then extend that. They extrapolate from there. They generalize to the population. Other data comes from hospitals and other medical settings. That's more the hard data of admissions and treatment and so forth.
So if you were going to give a survey like that, so when you say surveillance, I think that's what you mean. We're not suggesting that people are being looked at, presumably. How do you get that group? If you call somebody on the phone and say, hey, would you mind answering a few questions? They're probably going to cut you short if you're asking them about drug use. So do you find people, what kinds of settings are people found in such that they'll give honest answers to a set of questions like that?
Well, it's amazing. People tend to do that anyway. They sample according to sound scientific sampling processes, and they sample with replacements so that, you know, if someone turns them down, they go on to another person that meets their inclusion criteria. I've been involved in some of these activities in the past, and I've always been surprised at how willing people are generally, if it doesn't take too much time, to provide information.
And when they provide information, what kinds of things might they be asked about? I know that people worry very much about how leading are the questions when you give a survey. You don't want to lead somebody down a particular path. You want to find things out. So how do they go about making sure that they're not constraining the answers that people give so that they, you know, the best and most correct information, let's say?
Well, many of the questions are actually quite straightforward. It's about use and so forth. And, you know, before questions are utilized in the national level surveys, they're tested out and refined with smaller samples. So they have a pretty good sense of how to approach people to so that they can get the most valid data possible.
And so one of the things that we're going to talk about later when we talk about, let's say, the perception problem in America regarding this is people's belief that certain medications or drugs lead you down a path, a slippery slope, as it were, to more nasty, obnoxious, and harder drugs. And so how do people tease that kind of information out? How do they gather data that allows them to make some sort of supportable conclusion about causality between drug and things like that?
Well, it can be difficult, but the patterns of use you can extract from the data, and it starts to provide at least correlational level data. From there, you look at different research methods that allow you to still use correlational data, but to start to get a sense for causal patterns.
Okay, and so for causal patterns, if you were just to look at the major drug prevalence uses in the United States, people would categorize there would be legal drugs, of which probably there would be tobacco, alcohol, and perhaps diet pills at one time or things like that, and then there would be or even the prescribed drugs. And then there's the illegals that everybody knows about, cocaine, methamphetamines, heroin, marijuana, and things like that. So if you're trying to get causality established or even some sort of an idea of how much usage we have here, just what is the commonality? Is it tobacco is the most widely used, or alcohol is the most widely used, or how does that look typically?
You're going to look at somebody's history, their drug history. How did they start? When did they start? Under what circumstances did they start? Who introduced them to a particular substance? Things like that. And then you compile these various patterns from different people and start to get a sense of what precedes what. So, for instance, it's widely believed that marijuana is the gateway to harder drugs like heroin. And in fact, it looks like the prescription opioids are the gateway to heroin. People believe that smoking marijuana is the gateway to anything else. And it turns out, looking at the data, that tobacco actually is the gateway to most other kinds of drugs.
Now, do they try to tie that into psychological evaluation? Let's say they take a subset of these people and look at characteristics that they might have. So you and I talked on our own about things like risk aversion and willingness to accept various kinds of negative outcomes in your life. Do they do psychological studies where they try to look at personality types or personality tendencies to see how that kinds of stuff correlates with drug use?
Yeah, we've spent a lot of time looking at trying to identify this addictive personality, and we haven't been able to do that. But there are some things that are characteristic. So sometimes impulse control problems are an issue. Estimating risk accurately is another issue that can come up. Oftentimes people, clinically I can tell you that oftentimes people will get into substances of various sorts to try to deal with some kind of emotional or psychological pain, sort of numb out. And so it becomes a pattern, then it becomes a habit, and then it can escalate from there.
So when you categorize things and recognize that there are things that connect psychological behavior to drug abuse, how do you as a psychologist try to help people with that? Is it behavioral modification, or what kinds of things do you guys do to try to help people surmount those sorts of things?
In the broadest sense, it's all behavior modification. You're helping someone change their behavior. In the stricter sense, behavior modification has been tried with addictive behavior with mixed results. The research indicates actually that most things show mixed results. Even things like AA, which is widely touted and believed to be the most effective treatment for recovery, mixed results there, and it may be overestimated at this point. So recovery is a really individual process. Everybody, even though they're struggling with the same sort of demon, everybody approaches it from a different angle and comes from a different background. There are some things that are correlated, however. For instance, other major mental health issues correlate with substance use. About 50% of those that have a substance use problem have another major mental health issue. Trauma histories, trauma, earlier on in life, up to 70% of people have those kinds of issues. Is that causative? It's hard to say. Does it play in? It seems to. I mean, as a treatment professional, I know that, when people start to deal with some of those tender issues, those old issues, that it becomes easier for them then to get into recovery and stay in recovery.
So when you talk about mental health issues, what's the most likely ones? Depression, is that the most likely thing that might be linked, or are there other kinds of psychological issues?
It's interesting you should mention depression, because it's often assumed that people get depressed and then they start drinking, for instance. But research back in the late 70s by Valent and others found that it looks like the drinking precedes the depression. So there's not that causative link there necessarily.
So then if you've got people that come to you and they have an issue, or if people are identified and have an issue, we're going to talk more about this in a minute. How does their perception, their own perception of their problem and the public's perception, maybe it's their family's perception, maybe it's the general public's perception. I know way back in the day, people used to think about the lovable drunk, whether it's Otis on the Andy Griffith Show or whatever you might think, or they think about the mean drunk. But now there's a categorization, it seems like, where people think, well, prescription drug abuse is one thing, illicit drug abuse is another thing, drinking is another thing. So how does a person or their family's own perception influence their ability to recover from that?
Well, it can be if say, for instance, a person's family thinks that it's a morally reprehensible to be doing whatever the person is doing, that certainly can make it more difficult for that individual to get into recovery and find the kind of support that they need. It's oftentimes the case that if a family can understand that somebody is struggling with an illness, then that frame around it helps them to pull the moral aspects out of there, and then they can actually participate in someone's recovery.
Right. So what about that as far as perception? Because the country in general has always had sort of a perception. Drinking alcohol, there was a public perception about that, that if you did it in moderation, it was just, I wouldn't say as American as apple pie, but certainly in some parts of the country, nearly as American as apple pie, whereas other drugs are just viewed with almost palpable distaste. So when you look at survey data and you look at survey data to describe the prevalence of drug use, do people also look at survey and other kinds of data that indicate the public's perception of drug use? Do people have a good handle on how people feel about it? Because that's going to dictate at some level how we respond as a nation to these kinds of things.
Absolutely. There have been opinion surveys and surveys that get at those perceptions that have gone on since the mid-60s for sure. And perceptions vary across time. Back in the 60s, the perceptions around marijuana started to shift, and it's gone up and down since then. Currently, I think the last statistic I heard was that over 50% of Americans now believe that marijuana is not really a problem. So that's a big shift from historical patterns. And attitudes towards other substances also vary across time. Heroin, I think, wasn't a huge issue prior to the 60s, and during Vietnam, a lot of heroin came back from overseas, from the Far East, and that started to really color perception as well. I don't know that it's the perception of heroin has improved, except that maybe it's people are a little bit more wary, because the heroin that's on the street these days is much more potent and oftentimes laced with other things that are even more potent and make it more dangerous.
You know, that's interesting to me, because when you talk about drugs and you think about decades that are associated with drugs, many people would say that the decade of the 80s, at least from a thematic point of view, might be cocaine. That was sort of the drug of choice for, let's say, yuppies or upper crust people. And yet I don't remember, having lived through that and been in my early to mid adulthood, I don't remember it being described as a crisis ever really. And so it's kind of interesting to me that this opioid crisis label is attached to people. Is that because the lethality of heroin as a depressant is more significant, or what's the what makes heroin become such a buzzword or just a hot topic issue lately?
I think the lethality of all the opioids has really pushed this. If you think back to the 80s and when cocaine in all its forms hit the scene, it was a significant problem, but we didn't have people dying from overdose like we do now with the opioids. There were other social issues involved. Many more people went to jail because of crack, which was often used by folks, of color and lower SES, and so it became almost a black-white issue. Now, this is sort of crosses all borders. It's the culture as at large. The most likely person to die from an overdose of an opioid, though, today, is between 25 and 45 and white.
interesting, right? And so now let's talk about the issue where if somebody had a lower back injury and was prescribed some sort of probably OxyContin or whatever, and they got hooked on it, and then they got a couple of extra prescriptions written by somebody and so forth and so on. Most of the time, people are still going to treat this as a health-related issue. Oh, it's unfortunate you went down this slippery road towards addiction, and now we'll put together all the resources at our disposal to get you out of them. At least that's the way it seems to me. Whereas when you hear about people shooting illicit heroin, you don't seem to get much sympathy from the crowd. Is that still something that's going on, or are people treating it also more like a health issue?
It's some of both, actually. I think that there's still the attitude that if you're shooting heroin or something like that, that it's still morally reprehensible. Whereas if you inadvertently got hooked on an opioid because of some medical condition, then that's somehow more acceptable. It's paradoxical because, you know, again, you know, there are many more people that are addicted to prescription opioids than to heroin. Many more die from overdose from prescription opioids than from heroin. I don't know if there's a great explanation for it other than old attitudes are, you know, sometimes change very slowly.
Well, you know, you must hear this kind of thing and being a psychologist about people that have a lot of ideas and theories about conspiracies and various kinds of things. And so a lot of people would latch onto this. I know you must have heard about this episode in California where there was an overprescription of medication for old folks in nursing home facilities that apparently they didn't need. So some people would say that Oxy and these other things were given a pass because they were pharmaceuticals and that doctors went down the slippery slope of overprescription because of that. It doesn't seem that way to me. It seems like things sneak up on people. Which is the fairer assessment? Do you think things just sneak up, that people don't realize, gee, I shouldn't be prescribing these as much as I am, almost like overuse of antibiotics?
Well, I think there was some downplaying of the risk of some opioids, at least prescription opioids, by the pharmaceutical industry. There's evidence to support that. And so doctors oftentimes would be doing, you know, what they thought was right. But oftentimes they would also prescribe a larger amount than maybe someone needed. So it's not unusual for, you know, like with back injuries and other kinds of injuries, for someone to come out with a lot of extras. And that's where the teens get them from. They take them from someone else who's been legally prescribed them, and then they start to experiment and so forth. So I think that it's not all one or the other. I think, right, you know, it really is a confluence of things, unfortunately. And so, you know, we can spend a lot of time trying to point fingers, or we can figure out how to address the problem. And fortunately, like I said, the medical community is really stepping up,
sure,
and is starting to address this well.
But now addressing the problem, can you address it without lots of money? I think some people would like you to believe that just a pre-education effort for the young people, like have a conversation with your kids about drugs, is going to be the way to fix it. I'm not sure that's right. And so can you fix the problem? Because if you fix it with incarceration, that costs a lot of money, and there's also a lot of human capital that's going to get wasted. And if you try to fix it with treatment, that could be costly too. So what ways are the community looking to try to actually address this?
Well, right now we're still in a mode where we want to try to do this through the war on drugs that continues and is not very effective. The sad part of this is that if somebody really wants treatment, they are going to have to work hard to find it. And it's not going to be cheap, even if they can find it. In fact, sometimes, depending on the substance, some of the more prevalent and effective treatments are found in prisons, right, which is unfortunate. So somebody has to go to prison to actually access appropriate care. So I think that even though it is going to cost us money, you know, there's a statistic I had back from 2013 that we were losing over $78 billion a year due to the opioid crisis. So we can decide, you know, how much of that we want to spend on treatment versus incarceration.
Is that partly lost productivity? Is that where they think most of that number's coming from, or?
It's lost productivity. It's direct losses, you know, the cost of care when somebody is dying and so forth. So it's emergency services. It's the whole nine yards.
So for just a minute here, we'll talk a little bit about the political aspect and how it got politicized. Tell us about, just in general, at some level, why these things tend to happen, where it becomes a political hot potato at some level.
Sometimes it all comes down to one individual. So, for instance, with marijuana, there was a gentleman back in the 30s that thought marijuana was awful and launched this one-man campaign of trying to make it the scourge of the Western world, and succeeded for the most part. Succeeded in, you know, having it included in the list of substances like heroin and morphine and so forth. So our political views can be influenced by just a few people sometimes.
Okay. Well, this is a lot of information to chew on. I really appreciate you coming by. Thanks for stopping by and talking with me about this issue, Joe.
My pleasure.
So once again, this is Dave Cornielsen for STEM Spots signing off.
STEM Spots is available online at ksmu.org.